This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And I am waiting for a call-in from Douglas Preston. So while I'm waiting, I'm going to be checking up on him. Who knows, with the weather and everything else happening, I'm going to check on him. And while I check on him, we're going to play a song that is really wonderful. It's one of my favorite songs by Haley Woolbright, and she is going to be a guest next week, so we're going to play her song, Boxcar. I love listening to this song. It puts me in such a good mood, so I hope it puts you in a good mood, and I look forward to talking to her next week. But meanwhile, let's play that song, Big Ed, and I'm going to try to contact Douglas and see where he is.
Stowed away on this boxcar for quite some time. We plan to ride it all the way from Maine to Anaheim. But things change and people do too. My company's gone. I could choose to step off and make my way back. company's gone. I could choose to step off and make my way back home, or I could choose to keep moving on. My time is come and gone. Maybe I'll stay my welcome, but I've outgrown this boxcar and I'm headed down the
Thank you. That was great. I has to put me in a good mood. I am going to be having a fun day today. Do you realize it's February already? What happened to January? We're all crazy. Anyway, my guest is on an airplane somewhere, and we're not going to be talking to him today, but we will talk to him on the 8th. When is that? That's going to be on Thursday. So we will talk to him on Thursday. My goodness, what am I going to do? I have to talk. I have to talk today because I really have absolutely nothing prepared. It's been a very exciting January, I can tell you. I have been like going crazy with one thing after another. So, well, what shall we talk about? I will say to everybody, to my good friends who might be in town, Bria Burton, if you are available, give me a call. Call here to the studio and we can talk, because it is very exciting that you are going to be a guest host again in February. And I am so excited that you have been doing this once a month now. And that's what I plan to do, because it's so much fun to give really the sci-fi authors an opportunity to get out there and really get on the radio and talk about their books, because they, you know, it's so funny with sci-fi writers particularly. I find, you know, they do really live in another world, and they are so much world building all the time, and it is complicated, and I admire them so much. You know, it's nice, you can write a book about, you know, going to the beach and finding true love or something like that. You know, you don't have to do a lot of research. You don't have to do a lot of world building. It's right there for you. Or you do a story about, you know, a family, and you know your family, and it's right there. But for sci-fi authors, it is amazing. I have seen some of the research from several different by authors. And they have, I mean, the incredible amount of information that they gather. What you see in their book is nothing compared to what, you know, they've had to do to build that world. And when they do, you know, these worlds come alive, and it is, I admire them so much. I don't know how they do it. So many of them are still using just Word to do it, which is very difficult. But there are other programs that you really need if you're going to be doing something as massive as that. I know one sci-fi author who has maybe, although his books are, you know, like 300 pages, his research for that book would be, perhaps he's read like 10, 20 books. And it is so wonderful how he has been able to figure out a way to really make this whole thing you know, something that he's able to do. So I'm just waiting to see. I think we're going to have a call in. I hope we're going to have a call in. And Big Ed, you can interrupt me anytime you get somebody calling in, because I did invite anybody out there who wants to call in. You can call. Oh, okay. Well, you know, that's an idea. You know, if I don't get a call in soon from one of my friends who's in town, Bria Burton, Carol J. Perry, are you out there? Rita Murrow, any of you can call in. But if not, I do have a wonderful interview with Johnny Clark. Now, Johnny Clark is, and particularly I think at this time when we're really talking about the military and the great, wonderful men and women who are fighting for us. It will be so interesting to talk about the military. So I might be running that, but I also have invited Jim Lamb to call in. Now, Jim Lamb, of course, does our literary gems, and I am so thrilled with the work that he's been doing, discussing and explaining the elements of writing. And when I was talking to one of the listeners who did NaNoWriMo in 2023, the first time that she had ever actually written anything on the computer. She has written, she's been keeping little diaries, she said, over the years. She's someone who just, she had ideas for stories. She said she has one little notebook. And I said, I just have to see it. I told her she could, if she wants to take pictures of it, I would put it online, because she said it's at one point in her life, she just started thinking of titles of books, and she started writing them down. So I would love to just have that on the website, so people can see that you can come out with intriguing titles. You always think there's nothing new, but there are. So I'm just checking out. Is Jim Lamb on the phone? Okay. Well, thank you, Jim Lamb, to the rescue.
Can you hear me,
Jim?
Okay. Hi, how are you?
Oh, great. Oh, I am so happy that you called in, because although I can't talk, the funny thing is, you know, last week I did have a sore throat, and it's only now that, you know, it's over, but I'm still, you know, you get to that point, you don't want to overstrain yourself. So anyway, it is fantastic that you called in, and tell us, you know, one of the things, as I said, about your literary gems, where you talk about elements, but also tell us something about your poetry. So which do you want to talk about first?
Well, I was going to try to talk about overcoming writer's block, because so many people seem to have it.
Oh, that's a great subject. Perfect.
Okay. See, here's what I want them. Well, let me give you some background. I worked in the newspapers about 20 years, and I have done freelance writing and written a couple books since I retired. So I'm very familiar with a blank page. But what what some people have, like, you know, some people have like claustrophobia when they're in an elevator. Other people look at that blank page and they shut down. And the trick is to get anything on the page. So this can apply to one degree or another, a poetry, prose, news writing, feature writing, anything like that, because you want to start somewhere. With my poet, for example, sometimes I just have a word or two, and I'm not trying to write the whole thing down, but I drop that down, and then I come back to it. Sometimes I may have five or six items on a page, each one addressing a different poem, and I look at one, and I say, oh, I know what's coming next on that one. So because I'm not trying to write it all at once, and I think people, what they're intimidated by is not so much the blank page, but the idea that they have to start at the beginning, go to the middle, and get to the end. Because what happens then is you get stuck on the beginning. Well, as I learned in news writing, sometimes when you're writing, you can start in the middle. You can start at the end and then write to it. So let's say you're writing something, and I pick this as a good example, because I really believe people with a desire to write, but no outline to write, they might belong to a quilting club, they might belong to a roller skating club, and they may go hiking with friends. And a lot of these organizations will have monthly or quarterly newsletters, and it's a great way to get your feet wet in terms of writing something, especially since it has a built-in audience. So the example I'm going to use today is Marble. I'm working on it right now. It's going to be a short article, but it could develop into a book. So instead of trying to write it, I start researching it. Now I don't have a blank page anymore. I went online. I found out the history of marbles. They actually go back to Egypt. I found out that in the United States, there were many companies making them. And, of course, like a lot of businesses, there are fewer and fewer who make them. And there's actually a marble museum. So as you do your digging and you're putting things on the paper, guess what? Now you have two or three pages of research. You do not have to start with a blank page. And as you go through your notes, and the way I like to do it, I write the notes longhand, then I type them up triple spaced. So when I print it out, I can write ideas in between it. And then it's just like when you're building a cake, or I don't bake, but you know, you have the dry ingredients, you have the wet ingredients, and then you put them together in a certain way. You heat it for a bit, and you end up with a cake. If you follow the method I've just said, you now have two or three pages of good little nuggets. And as you look at them, you say, oh, that would be interesting to start here, the big marble tournament that happens every year in Tennessee or Kentucky. And then from that, you can start going into the history. So if you get something on the page, and this can be true if it's your club, if it's your quilting club, you can put something about someone who just finished a quilt they've been working on 5 years, and then transition into how they started it, how they put together, the obstacles they overcame. And that could be true with any other item. And the exciting thing is you get so involved in researching and gathering information that all the pressure goes away. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And that is so true. And this is you mentioned several things that I think are really great advice for people. First of all, I want to immediately mention this idea of printing out and having things triple spaced. I have discovered so many authors, you know, I tell them that you don't find like the mistakes or the problems with your story unless you actually print it out. The eye just works differently on paper than it does on the computer. Somehow things look a lot nicer sometimes on the computer than when you print it out. But the people make the mistake of just doing a single space. Again, it's the eye. The eye gets how our eyes work and how the information gets in our brain is very specific. And if you double space or triple space and leave that space there so you can put those notes, that is so important. I think people really improve their writing when they follow that system.
I'll give you another example, because, you know, I've done news releases for Joy on Paper. I've done it for other organizations in town, some nonprofit, some that are, you know, businesses that are selling an item or they're having brand new service or product. I do my editing, have my wife back read me because she's just got an excellent broad skill set in terms of reading and writing. She's written more technical things for when she was in the business assisted living. So I take it down. I read it, and I know I read it 10 times. I print it out. I look at it, and, you know, I'll find two or three mistakes on a page that I never saw on the computer, even though I was reading it over and over and over again.
It's true. Absolutely. And that's like one of the reasons our brains are very specific. You know, they have all these gray cells and they all do something. And the difference between handwriting and something, like if you're writing a poem, I think if you're writing it, I don't think I could write a poem just on the computer. I need that physical, that feel that connects me to the paper. Now, with maybe after years of you know, you typing, it's easier for you. But there is something magical about feeling, you know, your connection to the paper.
Yeah. The thing is, when you have it in your mind and it's floating around, it sometimes it looks beautiful, and then when you get it on paper and begin to structure it, you see where the holes are. So, but it. You want to do it all. Like I may have told you just in our conversation, my back room is my writing room, and I've got my iMac sitting in front of me. I've got reference books, reference material, a lot of little different color pens and whatnot. But occasionally I'll just hit a bump, and I because I'm positioned in the what we call Florida room, of course, I look out the back window and I have a little pond that I guess about 100 of us share. I get my little corner, but if I take a minute or two and just glance outside and get that mental vacation and see a fish jump or see a bird fly in, and once we had manatees actually come in from the river, it's like taking a deep breath. So you may need to get up and walk around the kitchen, or you may need to go somewhere, but never believe yourself when that idea of a writing block comes. Because you can always, there are so many little tricks you can use to get yourself back on track. With my poetry, I started writing poetry 10 years ago, and for 5 years I just wrote things, and it was terrible. I could not get it. I could not get the rhythm. So I stopped for a while. I went back, looked at all the poems I had written over 5 years, trashed them all. They were lacking something. And I think what I finally did is I didn't try to write a poem. I tried to tell a story. I tried to share a moment. I tried to get a snapshot of an emotion. And now, because that was my new motivation, not to write a poem, the poetry just seemed to flow.
Well, and that's so apparent in your book, Herding Butterflies, where you just, it's almost like you've taken a breath and then you just start writing, and it's magical. I there's one particular one that I was thinking about the other day. It's this I have flowers, birds, knobs, and dreams, and you just start off so easily. It's the flower, not fertilizer, we remember.
Oh yeah.
I love that opening.
Yeah, and the thing is, my wife is a gardener. She has a green thumb, I have a brown thumb. When one of our kids were born, and she gave me so few chores to do. One of them was watering the flowers. I don't know if I watered them and drowned them or didn't water them or starved to death, but she never asked me to do that again. But the thing is, watching her do it and watching her with care taken, not just plant a seed. I remember one time, we were just talking yesterday, there was a particular plant she had, and she took the leaf, took a pin, held the leaf against the curtain, put the pin in it, and from there it began to root. that sounds so crazy. And yet, it totally opened my eyes to see what I thought planting flowers was one thing, and it turned out to be many other things. And with writing, the same deal. You think it's got to be done this way. Well, if you begin to read how writers do their work, yes, some follow very strict patterns. Some just are, you know, wild and fly by the seat of their pants. But they have found a system and picked up hints and tricks and put it in their bag of tricks or in their tool chest, and they take the right one out at the right time, and that's how they get through to the end of a story or the end of a poem. But if you're afraid to start, you'll never finish.
And one of the things is, if you do start, you feel so good, even if it's just a page. When you finish it, there is that joy that you know your words are on paper. They're real. And I love the idea of doing research on a subject and just letting it take you where it takes you. And, you know, I'm already excited now to read your book that features marble. You know, Ayn Rand was very interested in marble. And if you remember her books, she often references marble and sculpture, because for her that feeling of marble was so important. And if you remember that scene from the Fountainhead, where you know, you have this wonderful, wonderful scene that features marble, and I think that you've got something here. You have just right there. You've got a subject ready to really turn into a great story.
And the thing is, I'm glad you brought that up. It's not unusual that if you're reading another book, and in the course, and I just had one of the authors you've had on in the last month said this, they were looking at a book and found a little part of a story and became curious about it, and then dug into it more. It might have been the one about the man. It was something about boats, and it may have been copper. Anyway, he saw that little nugget. It's just like going for gold. You dust, it's rocks, junk, an old tin can, and suddenly you see something that's different, and because of your experience, you say, that's gold. You can find those nuggets everywhere. In the encyclopedia, in a book, in a poem, on a TV show, and something little light goes on in your head that says, you know, I could take that deeper and do more and develop a story from that. And if you're a writer, nothing you do is wasted. If you go to the store, if you go to the fruit market, and you ask someone, how do I tell the good cantaloupe from the bad cantaloupe, and he shares that little bit of knowledge, you could work that into the book with the character. One of your main characters goes out shopping as he's finding, let's say he's following someone through the streets of Morocco, and he's trying to stay hidden, so he turns occasionally and looks at the ware being sold, and then he sees something he likes and he buys a new hat, and for a moment he forgets he's chasing the bad guy. I mean, just think how a real experience you've lived, now you can share it from reality, put it into fiction, and it helps you carry the story to the next level. It's amazing. Happy things, it doesn't have to be happy. You could lose someone, like I lost my youngest brother, and the pain, I was stunned. And I remember crying and thinking, he's 18 years younger than me. I'm an old guy, and he was a young man. How could this happen? But that pain is real, and if I'm sharing a story, and it makes you vulnerable, and sometimes you got to be vulnerable, you share that pain through the character, and the other people, the reader, feels it and knows it's real and genuine and not just made up because you pull up a thesaurus.
And speaking of a subject like that, there are, for people who are saying, well, I don't know if I, you know, what I should write, or everyone has family, you know, good and bad. And there are so many resources in a family also to, I think one of the nice things for people to do is to go to their relatives, to the relatives perhaps that they haven't spoken to for years, and ask them for their stories. Because if you start, once you start on that path, and it's more than, you know, just looking for your DNA, it's looking for the stories of what made your family. And boy, oh boy, everybody's got at least one relative that they can turn into a major story.
Oh, and I'm thinking, they're pouring into my head as you're saying this. I had an Uncle Steve, was really my great Uncle Steve, and he knew Jack Dempsey. Now, I'm not saying he was buddy-buddy to him, friends, but he had a picture, and he was in a picture with Dempsey, and that was, for a 10-year-old, that's all I needed to know. In my mind, he was Jack Dempsey's best friend. So he would talk to me about boxing and what to do, and even bought me, I think it was a pair of boxing gloves, you know, kids gloves, and taught me a couple moves. And I felt like I was learning from Jack Dempsey. And that, I mean, that's a story I could share someday. But the fact that the seed of the story, and I recognize it, and I have that away for a day that I need it, the way he cooked steaks. He said, Jimmy, you never overcook a steak. He'd get the pan so hot, he'd throw one side in, and it just sizzled and popped. And then just as it was getting seared nicely, he flipped it over and did it again. So the middle was pink. The outside had this, you know, this bronze and dark, and the sizzle was incredible. I mean, I can almost taste that steak now. There'll come a time where I want to share, have my character have that, and I can describe it to a T. So there's nothing wasted. If you're a gardener, so many things you do relate to writing, and if you pay attention, you'll connect the dots. If you're a craft person, like sewing the quilts I talked about earlier, if you really study a beautiful quilt, you begin to see how a story is put together. It's just, you can't, you just open your eyes, and all of life is giving you something. And don't worry about the blank page. Don't worry about the perfect sentence. Jot all the little pieces down. Go to that notebook on a regular basis, and sooner or later, you'll see a few dots that connect, and you're halfway to starting the story.
And it's so wonderful when these come to you, because it's when I was a little girl, one of the biggest things for us, every December, we would get this wooden crate with oranges. Now, in northern Michigan, we didn't have oranges. I mean, we didn't have supermarkets. So when we'd get, and it would come up on a train all the way from Florida through Chicago and to the Upper Peninsula, because people have to remember, in those days, we still didn't have the bridge that went connected Michigan. Everybody always thinks we got things from Detroit, but we didn't have a bridge that connected northern Michigan to southern Michigan. So wow. All of our stuff came from, you know, whether it was clothes or anything else, came from Chicago, because that was a direct train. And we'd get this wonderful, wonderful wooden crate of oranges. And I discovered not too long ago, you know, over the years, it was a big thrill when we were kids to get that, because nobody else in town had oranges. Nobody else had a relative in Florida who would send them oranges. And it was turned out to be my Uncle Wino, who was he was sort of a boxer, wrestler. He would do whatever exhibition show he could get. And he had all sorts of names, like the Crazy Finn, or, you know, the Viking Swede. He would take any name that would suit his personality. And but he would send us those oranges. And I only recently discovered, from doing some research, that they actually came from not far from the studio. There was an orange grove near the studio. And so the oranges I was getting as a kid, isn't it a strange thing what happens in life? These golden threads that I would never have imagined as a kid, that one day I would be living, you know, in the orange grove, practically in the orange grove where those oranges came from.
That is amazing. Speaking of oranges, and just the little brain connections in my head are just popping. When I was a kid, one of the big things to get in your stocking was an orange. Of course, a bad thing would be a piece of coal, and I grew up in a coal town, so I was very familiar with that. But I remember those oranges were like gold treasure, and you'd peel them so slowly, and you'd just take a bite of that slice of orange, and the orange juice would drip down your chin, and you just thought you were in heaven. Now that I'm in Florida, I don't eat as many oranges. I really on a kind of a tangerine binge right now. But these things that were so treasured, and I still could close my eyes and see the moment getting that orange out and peeling it, and it's just that's a great kind of a feeling you could convey in a book or a story or something else, and it could be a pizza.
Exactly, you know, and back to oranges, because for us, because it was December, and of course it was outside, we had, you know, 6 feet of snow out the window. My sister and I would sit by the window to peel the orange, as you said, very slowly, and there's like a sort of a spray mist that comes out of an orange. And when you have it, you know, in the sunlight, It's like a magical fruit. We used to really think it was magic from Florida.
Well, that's true, and I don't think Floridians realize that. I don't think Floridians, because like we had a tree in our backyard that it died after one of the frosts. But you just walk out, grab one, and come back in and have it. Up north, more so for you than for me, that was like almost something from another planet. I mean, it was just, especially winter, when everything was green. In my town where I grew up, it was basically gray skies 4 to 6 months of the year. So I'm sure it must have been that and more, and probably colder where you were.
Oh, yeah. It was cold. But and it was so magical to have those, and we didn't waste a thing. My mother would, you know, then of course candy them, the orange peel, and make orange cake, and everybody in town would get, you know, she would make these cupcakes, orange cupcakes, which again, they didn't have them. I mean, we just, when you look back at it and you think, you know, of course, we were very late in everything in northern Michigan. So we were like 10 years or 15 years behind in getting televisions. I mean, my brother still has to drive to the top of the hill to get cell reception.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's I mean, we're out in the middle of nowhere. So it was, you know, but again, that's why I have so many stories to tell. And all of these people who as you say, I could just talk to any of my relatives and they could give me a story that would make a great book. I don't have enough time anymore.
Well, I'm right working on 3 news releases. And as soon as I do that, I'm going to take a little break to try to get back some of my own writing. I mean, for me, it's I was very, very blessed to start real writing with a newspaper because you had something to do every day. And sometimes it was a clown at the mall, and sometimes it was historic building burned down. So I did not have the obstacle to overcome to get ideas. Now, I did have, you know, 3 to 5 stories to write at any given time, but I knew places I could go if I didn't have something breaking or happening or newsy. You could drive around to one of the schools and find a class making gingerbread houses or dyeing T-shirts or something. So it took a little bit of work, but it's not as bad as it is for me now because I'm pretty much homebound. But once you develop that method, once you develop that, get that block, that writer's block out of the way and take notes and get started, at some point, and this may be hard to believe, the story starts writing itself. It won't write itself if there's nothing on the page. It's going to help write itself if you research it.
And when you do, when you start, of course, when you start writing, you don't have to, people always will say, you know, well, I don't have a degree, I didn't go to college. That's not important. The words, it's really when you look at it, I mean, you don't need fancy words for a book. The words are in your heart. The words are also in the back of your mind because you've heard them, but you haven't used them. And then once you start working with words, once you start putting the words down, they start coming to you. And that's one of the, really, the why I call it joy on paper, is that wonderful, wonderful feeling that that you get when you see your words on paper.
Yeah, one of my favorites, Ernest Hemingway, who was also a journalist, and his style, some people think it's simplistic, and in a way it is, because he doesn't waste words. He doesn't try to impress you with long words and long sentences. They're almost rough sometimes, but he conveys information like a word machine gun. And if you sit down, and I would recommend, if you've not read Hemingway, at the very least, read The Old Man and the Sea, because it reads as if it's ordinary writing. Just so it looks like it flows. But being familiar with his regimen, there's a lot of work going on. But that was a man who won a Pulitzer, and he knew all the tricks of the trade in terms of newspaper. He knew about deadlines. He knew about pressure. He wrote in a war zone. And yet, he never writes anything highfalutin. It's always something that, if you have an 8th grade education, 10th grade education, you'll get something out of it. If you have a doctor's degree, you'll get something out of it. He knew how to put the story together, and he did it by writing. Stephen King says read. I agree. But if all you do is read, you won't write. Get a balance between your reading and your writing. And like I said, now, I think this is the best suggestion I will give today. If you are a wannabe writer and you're a member of a club, I will bet you that club either has a newsletter or a web page or something where they convey things, and you can start writing for them, and maybe 250 words, 500 words should be sufficient. And now you have some traction. In a way, you've been published. No, you haven't been paid, but a lot of us, including me, wrote to get some writing experience and didn't always get the money we wanted out of it, but the writing itself was the goal.
Absolutely. This is great advice, because whether you are, in a club or an organization, when you offer to do that, they're usually so grateful for contributors.
And if keep up with someone else, if you dig around a little bit, I know Pinellas is known in the Tampa Bay area for having some active writers clubs. So if you feel like, well, I don't want to take the journey alone, if you're comfortable working with people and talking with people, then if you find a writer's group, some of them are large, 50 people, and some of them are small, maybe a dozen. But if you get around other writers and you begin to not critique each other as if you were a high-end editor, but as a fellow writer, and then don't fall into the trap of, forcing someone into a pigeonhole and making your writing be what they're doing. You can share things in the right writers group and get move along, help them, help yourself, and invariably they will have opportunities to write or to discuss writing. And then sometimes when you talk about it, your words become more real once they've left your mind, and then you can maybe make the transition to paper.
And most libraries, I think, have writing groups. I know in Largo, in my area, Largo, the Largo Library has a big, big group that meets every Saturday morning. And Newport Rishi also has a wonderful group.
Yeah, Newport Richey is, of course, a much smaller town, but the library has been a very welcoming place. I mean, when I still could drive, I would often go down there at least once a week just to look at the magazines, see which new books were in, and get a feel for, you know, what the trends might be. Now I do most of it on the internet.
And they're very supportive of their writers and help promote. As a matter of fact, many of them have been on Joy on Paper. They come down to the studio when they have a group of writers who are ready to release books. So that's one of the fun things I get to do, is to meet all of these authors who have been working on something. They got an idea. It's their first book. And I'm always so excited when I get a group from a library and they come in, you know, sometimes three or four of them at the same time. And we have sort of a relay interview, which is always fun for me.
Yeah, and I a plug. I have been a listener since almost day one. I think I was one of your first, at least within the first month or so, guests in your studio. And, of course, we've talked a lot since then, but Joy on Paper, I set my calendar and my an alarm on my phone to remind me, because I have learned so much listening to the writers you talk to about their struggles, about their challenges, about the fact that some days it's difficult. You could not get a better resource to kind of get up to speed than listening to Joy on Paper, because of the broad range of people and books that you have.
Oh, thank you, Jim. That's so kind of you. I've appreciated every one of your supportive emails over the years, and of course all that you've done for Joy on Paper, including dedicating your new book of poetry, Herding Butterflies, to my listeners. And this book is available at Amazon, in Kindle, and paperback version. And I really want to tell people, it is the ideal gift to give for Valentine's Day. The poetry in there is so delightful. There's such a nice collection, a wide-ranging collection of poems that are touching, poems that are thoughtful, and there's some love poems in there, and it's a wonderful gift to give, and it's called Herding Butterflies, and it's available on Amazon.
Well, thank you. I have given some away as presents for Christmas, and I have a couple I'm giving away for Valentine's Day, and they're not highfalutin. Remember, I started off as a ditch digger. And then I went to become a carpenter's helper. So I have, so to speak, come from the ground up before I got my degree at USF in mass communication and political science. So I can feel for people who might feel intimidated, but I can tell you it is worth the effort, it is worth the risk, it is worth your time.
And it is so much fun. It is also a craft. Writing is, you know, all for all the artistic part of it, it is also a craft. And you can learn it if you try, if you work hard. And I think of it as Leroy Jethro Gibbs method of writing, because he starts off with, you know, a sandpaper that is rough, and then over a long period of time, his sandpaper gets finer, he gets it smoother, it gets better, it shows the grain better. And that's what you have to do. You start rough, but you just keep fine-tuning it, until finally you have the finest sandpaper or the finest thing that you can do and that you can write.
No, and I love his character, and I love the boats he made in the basement, and I still can't figure out how he got those boats out without tearing down the house.
I know, and I do too. I love it as a. My dad was a lumberjack, and so for me, wood. When you love wood. And that it's a craft, and writing is a craft. You can get better, You just have to work at it, and you have to be patient, because if you go just rubbing with rough sandpaper, you're never going to have that beautiful final finish. So, again, that's one of the things that you're doing with your literary gems, telling us about the parts and the elements of writing, and I appreciate that so much. And I just have to mention before we go, and we have very little time, it's so funny that you would mention marble, because I have in one of my one of my scripts that was optioned, actually, it is about somebody who goes to Florence and goes to learn how to sculpt and works actually at Carrara, where, you know, of course, Michelangelo got his marble from. So I have a great love for marble and sculpting in general. So it's a strange and wonderful connection, and I hope that you will you know, get a nice book out of it, because as I said, Ayn Rand loved marble, and she certainly got the fountainhead out of it. And so who knows what you're going to make out of it, right?
That'd be interesting.
Okay, Jim, again, Jim Lamb, thank you so much for joining me today on Joy and Paper. You did rescue me, because I can think of a million things to talk about, but sometimes that's like too overwhelming. So you really focused us on the important thing. And people, you don't have to have writer's block. Just sit down and start doing research, or call up some relative you haven't spoken to for 30 years, and they'll give you an earful of information you'll want to start writing about. Right?
Right.
Okay. Thank you again, Jim. Thanks so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a joy to talk to you, as always.
Have a great day.
Okay. Thank you so much. And Big Ed in the control room. Okay. I made you nervous, but that's all right. We did okay today. You never know what's going to happen. Every day brings you a new and interesting thing. So say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. And thank you again, Big Ed. And on Thursday, I will have Douglas Preston, and we're going to be talking about a book that is, it's unusual. It's called 14 Days. Anyway, everybody, bye-bye now. We'll be right back.